Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Mark Peltier with Futures in Biotech Episode 9 for Wednesday, November 22nd, 2006. Metagenomics with Dr. Ed DeLong. Today's guest, Dr. Ed DeLong, is a professor at MIT, Division of Biological Engineering, and the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. I really wanted to interview Dr. DeLong because he uses cutting-edge technologies to study complex microbial communities in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Hawaii. In our discussion, he explains how genomics not only reveals important details on the nature of these marine microbes, but can also uncover genetic, biochemical, and even metabolic information with great potential for the development of new technologies, providing novel building blocks for synthetic biologists or genetic engineers. While seeking a better understanding of life in the oceans, he's extending our knowledge of the living world and discovering new genes in a way that's not unlike combing tropical rainforests for new species. I would also like to point out that we record these netcasts using Skype, and the bandwidth at MIT is either pretty slim or heavily abused. So at one point in the interview, we switch over to the phone lines, which in the end, I think, worked out pretty well. We also talk quite a bit about GenBank. GenBank's a database of most, if not all, genes that have been sequenced to date. It also includes entire genomes, and it is freely available, and I provide information on how to get to it at www.bit.tv/fib. So here's our conversation. Hey, Ed, how's it going?
Good. How about yourself, Mark?
So, you know, I guess my first question for you would be, and, you know, if I quote your webpage, you say, microbes have evolved to be the fundamental engine that drive the cycles of energy in matter on Earth, right? So the real question is, how does a bacteria that's like one or two microns, a millionth of a meter, influence world energy?
that's a good question, but
if you can answer, I guess, it in an hour.
There's a simple answer. And the simple answer is there's powers in numbers. So I could, you know, without getting into specifics, there are a number of cycles. Let me talk about one because it has to do with energy. So it turns out that off the continental margins, off of our continent, for instance, if you go offshore and then you start going deep in seawater below about 500 meters, and then you hit the sea floor, buried in those marine sediments is more methane, you know, natural gas, the stuff we use in our stoves and all that. There's more methane in terms of carbon buried off the continental margins than there is all the carbon in petroleum reservoirs on Earth combined. It's a lot of methane. Now, that methane, actually, some of it's biogenic. Some microorganisms called methanogens make that methane. And what happens is it kind of percolates up through the sediments, but then it hits cold seawater, and there's high pressure down there, and it actually freezes. So the methane that's stored off the margins is in a form that's called hydrates or clathrates, and it's basically methane ice. It's a huge reservoir. And it turns out that very little of that methane kind of percolates up into the water column, which is probably a good thing, because if it did and got into the atmosphere, it's a fairly potent greenhouse gas, for one thing. So why doesn't that methane make it in seawater? And the reason is there's teams of microorganisms. It's not just one microbe that can do this. It takes a couple, takes a village, basically, of a number of different types of microbes that can live deep in the sediments without any oxygen.
How deep are we talking about?
So it's below 500 meters water depth, but it can be as great as 1,000 to 3,000 meters. And then deep in the seafloor, maybe tens of meters, something like that, or deeper. But there's this methane ice is in huge amounts off the continental margins. And the bottom line is that these consortia, these teams of microbes, oxidize the methane as some of it's unstable, it percolates up, and basically oxidize it to CO2, and it just essentially no methane makes it up. And And that's an interaction, it turns out. It's a co-metabolism. So it takes a couple bugs, a couple microbes working together. The interaction has to occur over a scale of nanometers. But that interaction of those microbes in the deep sea that occurs on a scale of nanometers controls gigaton fluxes of methane on thousands of kilometer scales. So there's power in numbers, and there's also kind of power in metabolism. And I guess that's one of the points about the microbial world is when you think about diversity in plants and animals, the larger organisms that we can see, we're typically thinking about diversity of form, diversity in development, morphology, tissue differentiation. But when you get right down to it, plants and animals are metabolically really boring. It's absolutely true. Oxidize carbon in the same way. The basal metabolism is pretty same. What's really interesting, of course, is all the development and tissue differentiation and so on.
Sure.
But the vast majority of 3.6 plus billion years of evolutionary change in metabolic cycles is contained in the microbial world. And there's a memory of that. And any compound that you find out in nature that can yield energy, there's a microbe out there that either can use it or will adapt to use it pretty quickly. So the bottom line is, in terms of metabolic diversity, in terms of biosynthetic innovation as well, the vast majority of that exists in biota today is contained in this tiny invisible microbial world that really harbors actually the vast diversity of genes in extant sequence space today. And that's an interesting point with respect to looking at the current databases of genes and genomes. The reality is that what we sampled so far is reasonably skewed because we have tended to prioritize sequencing efforts based on kind of anthropocentric goals and initiatives, many involved with human health as they well should be. But by doing that, what we've got is just a really tiny sampling of extant gene diversity that exists on our planet in many different environments. And, you know, just as I said that a lot of that gene diversity is harbored in microbes, so it turns out that a very, very small number of those microbes have been domesticated in the lab. And those are the ones that we've tended to focus on.
Right. So I guess extreme environments require extreme genomes, you know, and extreme diversity.
It's kind of interesting. You'd think that. But when you get right down to it, if you take a look at hymerthermophiles, organisms that live in, you know, at 110 degrees Celsius and so on, you know, they have really small genomes. Organisms that have to make everything that they need. So take a cyanobacterium. Some of them live in extreme environments, but let's take one that lives in
a cyanobacterium. So that's a photosynthesizing bacteria?
A photosynthesizing bacterium. It's got green chlorophyll just like plants. But some of these cyanobacteria, they can live off, they can use nitrogen from the air, so dinitrogen gas, CO2, and sunlight to make a living. So you give these guys water and a couple gases and sunlight, and they can make whole cells, and, you know, amino acid biosynthesis, all the biosynthetic pathways, and so on. So that seems like, wow, that's making life from simple gases, nitrogen, CO2, water, a couple other elements, and sunlight. That must be really complex, and yet these guys have some of the smaller genomes that are out there, some of them. So 1.5 million base pairs is enough to make living cells from simple elements and gases, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it. So that's where you can kind of start to see the biochemical and metabolic and physiological versatility that's contained in the microbial world. So you've got organisms that can live beyond the boiling point at one atmosphere. You've got these organisms that can basically live off gases and sunlight. And so on. So there's a really large amount of biosynthetic capabilities that can be tapped into that we don't even fully understand. We can kind of guess what sorts of microbes are going to be out there based on thermodynamics. You can kind of do the calculations on what sorts of things can be oxidized, coupled to the reduction of other compounds to yield energy. And whenever you come up with a coupling that works, something that yields energy, you can generally find a bug out there that's capable of making a living doing that.
So if there's chemistry that's appropriate, so every time you go out there and look, you find a new bug. It must be.
Well, it's a little daunting, but it's not. It's getting better, and the reason is sampling techniques. I think people are being more systematic, and actually, the power of really genome sequencing and nucleic acid sequencing technologies and kind of ancillary quantitative methods like quantitative PCR, microarrays, proteomics is starting to be used now. What's happening is starting, and it's only the start now in environmental science, of a transition from a kind of qualitative observational mode into a more quantitative mode. Actually, it parallels what you see happening in biology and systems biology, a movement towards more quantitative precision in terms of measuring organisms, genes, metabolic activities and fluxes and so on.
Well, now, of course, it seems to be really simple on various specimens. If you're working on a mouse, you don't have to separate that mouse out of a zoo, right? You've got a soup, right? So how large is a microbial community, right? How many different kinds of species are you finding in your various samples?
That's an interesting question because it turns out that it's loaded. Whenever you back a microbiologist into the corner and ask them how many species there are or what is a species, it starts to get a little squishy. But here's one way to think about it. Let's just imagine, if you think about the way people have quantified things, what like beetle species, which are there's tens of thousands and that sort of thing. If you just imagine that every different plant that's out there in nature, and every animal has at least one or two or 10 or maybe 100 kind of its own symbionts or indigenous microbial species, you can kind of see that even if you just took animal and plant-associated microbes, that you'd have a lot more than you'd have species of plants and animals. And then if you start looking more broadly into free-living microbes and all kinds of habitats where nothing else can live, like at 110 degrees Celsius or in saturated brines or at extremely high pressures and so on, there are a lot of microbial species, put it that way. And the estimates range depending on how you want to basically cut the pie, how you want to define species. But
right. I also like to say that probably if you look on, you scrape some, take a scraping off some paint, off the wall, you probably have like 10 different species that are surviving on the carbon that's in the latex paint, right?
Absolutely. I mean, people don't want to hear it, but I mean, the number of species that are probably on your shower wall might be very impressive. but the point is there's got to be at least tens of millions of microbial species, depending on how you really go about and define them, and probably lots more. And so...
Analogy be drawn to the the arthropods or the insects found in the rainforest? I guess there's a lot of species out there that haven't been looked at, haven't been grown, haven't been cultured. You don't know their genomes. You don't know their potential. Are you seeing this kind of thing?
Absolutely. And it's harder. It's more difficult though. I mean, one of the problems, of course, that microbiologists have to deal with is scale. So you start thinking like a microbe. I told you about those microbes interacting on the scale of nanometers. We have a tremendous sampling problem. So when you ask me, for instance, well, how many species are there in a community? Getting down to the level at which you can define what the niche is or what the community is difficult. And that's one of the reasons. So I'm working with colleagues out in the Central Pacific Ocean. There's a time series station out there called Station Aloha that's been studied for the past 20 years. And one of the reasons we like to
You couldn't have picked a puddle?
Yeah.
Outside the lab? I guess you wish you had.
Well, in some ways, yes, but in some ways, so there's a method to this madness. I mean, it's far away, but one of the things about the oligotrophic or nutrient-poor central oceans is that scales are kind of stretched. So this isn't a mud puddle where light can't penetrate. The light penetrates, the photic zone extends to about 200 meters depth out in the central ocean. So you can
That's still quite remarkable, 200
meters.
You go
200 meters down, and light still penetrates. And in fact, the chlorophyll maximum in the central ocean is typically around 130 meters or so. So the reason why these are really interesting habitats and communities to study is that the microbes are actually partitioned in layers. You know, think of it as a layer cake, and each layer has a different community that's adapted to particular light and nutrient conditions. Those communities are stretched out on the order of meters. And what that means is we can sample them, and we can sample reproducibly because they're, in essence, kind of self-organized with the gradient of light that's penetrating the water column and the gradient of nutrients, some of which are sinking, some of which are coming up from the bottom. And it's a very orderly kind of arrangement. And what that allows us to do is to go back and study the very same communities and be able to measure the physicochemical conditions time after time in a very systematic way. So although we actually like going out to the ocean. And
how far off are you exactly?
This is about 100 kilometers north of Hawaii. But the real kind of, and I'm, you know, this is not a bogus justifier either. The real reason for doing this is that we can understand those stratified communities, go back and resample them, and put them in the context of their physicochemical environment. And if we're ever going to make any headway towards trying to do systems biology in complex communities, it's going to start out in, I think, communities like this. Because if you go to the mud puddle in my backyard, or you go to a soil sample, it is so complex, and that complexity is seen on the scale of microns. And we're simply not good at systematically and reproducibly sampling that kind of complexity on that kind of scale yet.
I was wondering how you, if you had a mixed environment, how you would decipher which genome or which genes belong to which organisms. So that really answers that question, I suppose.
Yeah, in part, you need to be able to sample the community in space and time, which is kind of what I just addressed. But with the new genomic techniques now, it is becoming quite possible with very good taxonomic or phylogenetic markers to essentially walk the genome and figure out, you know, what sets of genes are associated with which particular suites of organisms. And that's where it starts to get really interesting, because if you really want to understand how genomes work, you can't really do it by studying individual genomes in the lab. And the reason is because genomes are dynamic. I like to say that genome's a verb, not a noun.
Right. Is that because they rapidly evolve, or what do
That's
you mean by
That's because term? They rapidly evolve, but also there's a in the microbial world, we have to start thinking about genome dynamics a little bit differently than we do for sexually reproducing organisms, plants, animals, and so on. And that is because lateral gene transfer, the swapping of genes in and out of organisms, is a major mode of evolution and innovation in microorganisms. And, I mean, think about it. When we talk about bacterial species, let's think about one of the best understood microbes around, Escherichia coli. You compare two strains of Escherichia coli, and they differ by a million base pairs, but we still call them E. coli.
Right.
And some of those differences between those genomes actually contain genes that have to do with their own particular lifestyle, the niche that they come from. So pathogenic strains have different suites of genes on genomic islands of E. coli, that is, than other strains of E. coli. And so we have to that's a major part of understanding how microbes work, is understanding kind of their fine-tuning and those kind of niche-specific details that can make something that we usually call the same species, you know, differ by 20% of the whole genome. And
so
that puts
is
a
it
different
possible
spin on
to sort of make get an idea of an assembly of or a community of bacteria?
It's becoming possible. It's not trivial, so I wouldn't cast it at
huge.
That. But what's becoming possible is to understand the diversity and microdiversity of particular species. And that's going on right now, and there's some really great examples of that, of how particular species come in different flavors, for instance, depending on what depth they live at in the water column. So they're tuned to different levels of light, and you can see that from some of their light-responsive photoproteins. They're also tuned to the gradient of nutrients that are coming up from below. And so you can actually, from the genome, associate particular properties like the ability to take up different kinds of nitrogen, the interaction with light, and so on. That information really tells you about where the organism's living.
I guess
so
you wouldn't even need to know if it's using nitrogen or you've got the genes that are present there for the use of nitrogen. You wouldn't even need to associate necessarily with an exact species of bacteria.
Well, sometimes that's true. The other thing that comes out of looking at communities is you start to get a sense of what particular suites of genes are what you might call cosmopolitan genes, so that they're actually telling you more about the environment that they come from than who they came from. We're studying a set of genes ourselves right now in marine microbes that weren't even known to be there about 6 years ago. And these are similar to the light-responsive proteins in our eyes, rhodopsins. So it turns out that a great number of many, many different microbial species that live in the surface waters of the ocean have rhodopsins. And these things are light-driven proton pumps. They're basically able to absorb a photon and then pump a proton out of the cell. And that proton can be used by proton translocating ATPases to make ATP. So these are
or energy, as energy. To the wider audience.
Yeah, so yeah. It's a basically, and we discovered these, by the way, by genomics. We were walking a genome fragment. What we've done for a while in my lab is make what are called bacterial artificial chromosome libraries. So the bottom line is you can take a mixed community from these populations in the ocean, for example, of depths. You can isolate their DNA and clone pretty large chunks, say on the order of maybe 100 kilobases, which could be on the order of 5 or 10% of a whole microbial genome.
And how many genes
clone.
Would that have?
About 100. There's about one gene per every kilobase, something like that. So 50 to 100 gene samples. You
some
know,
regulatory elements as well?
Okay. Yeah, everything that's in the genome.
Switches, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And so what we've been doing is archiving those, and we can look at phylogenetically informative genes like ribosomal RNAs and basically categorize who's in there. And then what we decided was, well, many of these types, these phylogenetic types, have never been grown in the lab. We have no clue about their genetics, biochemistry, physiology, and so on. So why don't we just walk from that ribosomal RNA into the rest of the genome, see what we learn? What we learned, like the second time we tried this, the second clone we looked at, was that some of these bacteria living in the surface waters of the ocean, quite common ones, they're all over our planet, have these light-driven proton pumps, these photoproteins. And in fact, we were able to take that photoprotein from the marine bug, put it in coli, and make E. coli pump protons with light. So we, in essence, can kind of quasi-convert E. coli into being a phototroph with these genes from the ocean.
Wow, that sounds a little bit of what Dr. Endy was doing in terms of synthetic biology, getting E. coli to act as like a photosensor or a CCD for camera.
You bet. That was using a different system. This is a system that actually lets, in fact, we've shown now that E. coli, we can make E. coli make ATP, that is make the cellular energy kind of currency with light, which is kind of remarkable. So
we're converting, Dr. Andy's group or team, for summer team, would be making cameras, and you could basically make a photocell or a, what do you call it?
Well, we can make a flashbulb, I guess. No, that's not true. We could power those. Basically, these are solar cells. And we're fooling around with that. It's not clear how useful it would be. And we're working with Druendi and their group on that, too. And a lot of the students have thought about how you might. So now, if you can power coli with light or power cells with light, how could you make use of that physiologically? So people have thought about all kinds of tricks you might want to play. But the point here is, I think we're getting to a good point, which is this, that there's a lot of biochemical diversity and innovation that has not been tapped into yet. And part of this whole kind of environmental genomics or metagenomics allows us to tap in to what nature's been messing around with for the past 3 billion years or so. And so it's grist for the mill. For me, it's looking at natural history. But for others, it's new tools and sources of innovation for application in synthetic biology. Now there's a point here that's kind of interesting. The reason we think when we go out in the ocean and look, it turns out that nature's been kind of doing this for a while. So these photoproteins, it turns out, have been moving around between very different species of microorganisms for a while.
How do they get around? How do the genes, do they simply jump, or does one bacteria eat another and then not completely degrade its DNA?
That's a great question. Probably, so that's kind of habitat specific. In a biofilm, a lot of gene transfer is probably mediated by things like conjugation, cells being really close together and having mechanisms to swap DNA in a quite specific fashion. In the ocean, what it looks like right now, although it's not 100% clear, is that phage, there's a lot of phage. So there's about 1 million microbes per milliliter of seawater. There's 10 times more phage. So any place you go in the ocean, if you count phage.
And this is in clean water?
Yeah, it's in clean water. Now that's the other point to make, right? This is clear blue water, and there's 100,000 cells per mil, and those cells are doing good things for the ocean. They're basically keeping it clean. They're processing all the organics coming through, and they're keeping it blue, basically. So there's 10 times more phage, though, and those phage are pretty active.
And phage are what exactly?
Phage are viruses. They're basically nucleic acids, genetic material wrapped in protein, and they're able to hijack the cell's protein synthesis machinery, so they can inject their DNA into cells and then take over kind of the cell machinery to make more viruses. So they can turn the cell into a virus factory, make more viruses, go out as free viruses and infect other cells to make more viruses.
So there's 10 times or 100
times?
10 times.
So there's
10 times more virus out there than there are bacteria.
Yeah, if there's 1 million cells per mil in coastal waters, that's about the right number, 1 million per mil, 1 million per teaspoon, more or less. There's 10 million phage. And in fact, this is dynamic, too. It's not like these cells are just floating around out there. The reason why whenever you go out, you can count a steady state number of about 1 million per mil is because there are little protists, protozoans, small microbial grazers that are eating those microbes, those bacteria, as fast as they grow. So cells in seawater typically have a doubling time of maybe about a day, and they're getting consumed at the same rate. And if you think about that, what that means is things are turning really fast. The ocean, if you will, has a pretty quick metabolism because those cells are doubling on the order of a day, getting consumed at the same rate. Whenever you go out, you count the same number, but it's not a static number. They're turning over on a daily basis. And some of that turnover is due to kind of a cat and mouse game between the microbes and the viruses wanting to find that host, and the host, the bacteria, continually changing, trying to evade those viruses. So there's this kind of dynamic cycle going on with respect to those host virus dynamics. And there's some really interesting findings with how that works. It turns out, you know, remember I talked about these cyanobacteria. There's ones that live out in the ocean. And of course, what they do for a living is they convert sunlight into energy. And they have what are called photoproteins in the reaction center that do this. So let's just call these reaction center proteins. Well, it turns out that many of the viruses out there in the ocean actually have hijacked those reaction center proteins. So a lot of the cyanobacterial viruses are carrying in their genomes the two important proteins in the reaction center. And the notion is that when they infect cells, the viral genes get expressed, but they're also expressing those host reaction center genes, so they keep the host cell energized. Even though they're hijacking its metabolism, they're basically feeding those reaction center proteins to the photosynthetic machinery so that the cell keeps making energy from light, not so it can help the cell out so much, but so it can make more viruses. So it's really kind of interesting. Amazing. The viruses are hijacking host cell metabolism, in this case photosynthesis, to make their own little babies. So it's a dynamic system, and it's really interesting, and these are the sorts of things in the kind of genomic realm that are starting to come to light, is the kind of this dance of genes, and what we're finding is that genes move around quite a bit more than was presumed in the past, and so you actually have to think about communities, because if you just look at an isolated organism or genome and try and make sense of it outside the context of its environment and its genomic environment, if you will, it's really hard to interpret. But if you look at the community of genomes and what genes are kind of moving among and between different species, and maybe the other ones that are really more transmitted vertically from mother to daughter, you can start to make sense of how genomes change, what's important with respect to the environment, and which genes are kind of more cosmopolitan and basically selectively advantageous for many different species. And these sorts of things are starting to come to light right now, which is really interesting, because what it really is a sort of a gene ecology overlaying on the organism ecology. And it's a kind of perspective that we really haven't had before. But if you want to understand how the system works, it's a good perspective to have. And
well, genetics it provides a fantastic rationale for life cycles.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right? It's really natural history is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The other thing that besides understanding the evolution of genomes and how all this gene ecology works, it's tremendously useful for just understanding ecology proper, if you will. Because now what you can start to do is in particular environments where you really have a good handle on the physics and chemistry of a particular habitat, you can start to lay on top of that the metabolic pathways, not just of a single organism, but the collection of organisms that are interacting. So their metabolic pathways are coupled in essence. And the dream of some of us, so it's not instantiated yet, but it's going in that direction, is to have, if you will, encyclopedic metabolic maps, if you will, like KEG, the Kyoto Encyclopedia of Genes and Genomes, except for habitats or environments, to understand the suites of genes that are important for particular communities and particular contexts, to grow and survive and evolve. And
let me ask you, are there, what is the term, a vestige genes or
vestigial
genes that are no longer vestigial?
Yeah.
Aha, thank you. Vestigial genes or cests that you're seeing that might reflect the history of the local environment that is no longer the existing environment, or things that have changed. Are you seeing that, or do the bacteria rapidly evolve and get rid of these genes?
That's a really good question, is can we pick up kind of the vestigial genes that tell us something about history? And that's, I think, going to be a little bit context dependent. In some communities, like these ones up in the surface waters of the ocean where turnover is so rapid, I think the rule of order is if you don't use it, you lose it. Things turn over pretty rapidly. So if you look at the nature of genomes in surface waters of the ocean, they're typically small and really quite streamlined. Some of the kind of smallest intergenic spacers that are found in whole genomes are found in organisms that live in these habitats. So they're whittling, they're lean and mean. They're whittling their genomes down. They're getting rid of anything, any nonsense. And there's very few, for instance, pseudogenes, transposases, any junk like that. And in fact, there's probably a tendency towards more overlapping genes as well. So in the surface water streamlined genomes, I suspect that vestigial genes are out of there pretty quickly. Now,
is there a field, or I don't want to coin a term, but sort of archaeological genomics? I mean, in the soils, there must be traces of bacteria that have been there for, you know, hundreds of years or 200 years.
Sure, there are people who are kind of thinking along those lines in terms of gene and genome archaeology. It's a tough game to play, but it's likely. I think that people are looking in those directions. There are, for instance, old salt mines. And in some of the salt inclusions, there's tiny bits of water and there's microbes in there that have probably been stored there, if you will, for hundreds of thousands, if not longer, years. It's tricky stuff, though.
I was sort of asking more in the context of the experiments that you do. Do you, in the, so you're sampling water or you're actually going into the soil, not the soil, but the sediment?
Sediments. We're kind of mostly, for the reasons I described in terms of being able to get that spatial and temporal resolution, more focused right now on the water column. But let me expand on that a little more. I said that up at the surface, genomes are streamlined. Well, we published a study in Science earlier this year where we looked at a profile, and we went through the water column sampling genes all the way down to about 4,000 meters depth, 4 kilometers in the water column in the deep Pacific.
Do you have a sub, or do you, no, just
you,
drop a
line? You have a line. Basically, there are ways to sample with what are called, they're simply bottles, basically Niskin bottles that you can lower over the side of the ship, and there's a long cable, and you can measure all kinds of things, oxygen, temperature, pressure, chlorophyll, fluorescence, all the way down, and then trip your bottles at any depth that you want. So you've got a record of the physicochemical environment as well as a sample from that environment. And this is a standard technique in oceanography, actually. Mm-hmm. But so we have this profile, and now on those physics and chemistry, salinity, temperature, pressure, and so on, nutrients, we're going to overlay the collection of genes that we find walking down into the abyss. And of course, many things are changing. The light gradient's changing. All of a sudden, light energy dwindles and disappears. Now you're talking about chemical energy sustaining microbial populations. Temperature goes down. Pressure goes up. All kinds of things are changing. What happens to communities or genomes? And it turns out that we found at least one really strong community-wide genomic trend when we looked in these very deep water populations. And that was this. The deeper we went, the more insertion elements, transposons and transposases, we found as a function of depth. So that at depth, there were many, many, many more transposases than we found in the surface. And when we looked at them, it wasn't just because there was one species that happened to be peppered with these things, but rather there were many different families of transposases.
And these transposases are often in sort of on the wider scale are referred to as jumping genes.
Yes, these are jumping genes.
So they can pop from one organism to another.
They can mobile elements. They can hop within the genome, and they can hop from organism to organism. And for whatever reason, and we really don't know the reason right now. But we know that, in fact, we've done some follow-up studies, and this is a real phenomenon, that as you get into these deeper water populations, maybe there's relaxed selection that acts against transposases. Hard to know, but the numbers go up dramatically, so that large percentages of the genomes of communities, of different species in communities in deep water are riddled with these transposases. Why we think that's interesting, we need to sort out what the particulars are of the why. But what we saw was that, yes, indeed, there are some trends that transcend just an individual species and actually are a community-wide trend that tells us maybe something about the selective pressures, the lifestyles, the habitat, that you're looking at, which is really kind of interesting when you think about it.
So how do you analyze, you know, these dynamic genomes? How do you get a good handle of what's out there genetically?
Well, so that's a great question, because it's one of the powerful approaches, of course, for understanding what particular genes do and what their identity is in a comparative approach. And what's happening with some of these techniques is we're going out into the wild blue yonder and sampling genes for which there are no homologs. And there are some estimates out there that suggest that we're still at a place, if you think of gene families, we haven't saturated yet. So the more you go out and sample, the more new gene families you're going to find. So we are in a place where it's highly exploratory right now, and that people are going to have to be really creative as we start to catalog this whole Earth catalog of genes and genomes, if you will, of really tacking functions on those, and as well as keeping good tallies and track of not only where those genes come from, but also, when we can, who they come from. And I think,
right, which might tell you what they do, might help you at least guess what they do.
It certainly will. So one of the notions about understanding gene function is simply to know where they came from. And so one of the biggies, actually, it's this field has so many parallels, I think, to what went on in the early days of genomics, and also kind of as microarrays started getting off the tracks there, and so on, in terms of, wow, all of a sudden we can collect in fairly massively parallel ways all these new sorts of data. What do we need to keep track of? And so one of the central discussions right now that is really important, and that is going to help in major ways people interpret these data sets in the future, as well as from a historical perspective, is capturing the right kinds of metadata. And that's a tricky thing, because all of a sudden, you know, I have a background in marine science and oceanography, and I work a lot with some really excellent oceanographers, and that's extraordinarily important, because now we're walking outside the laboratory. We have to think really hard about what kinds of physical data do we need to take, and what kinds of chemistry, and what sorts of things do we need to track to put this sample that I just took, the sample of a microbial community, into some kind of context, so that then I can compare it to
some
the next
tags,
sample.
Just meta tags, I guess.
Yeah,
tags
it's a simple concept metadata, but kind of getting that standardized, and as lots of people start going out and doing this, getting this all coordinated, that's
I can
the trick.
Totally understand how hard it would be to figure out what these genes are doing. Not just from the physical, even if you had the physical information, the chemistry, it could be a complete PhD program for a student to try and figure out the function of a unique gene that has never been seen before.
You bet.
I mean, it might have enzymatic properties, and nobody knows what the substrate or what the enzyme is working on. It can be enormously difficult. If you're pulling out new ones every time you go out.
If you don't have any homologs, it's going to be tough. But at least...
Well, it's sort of like shooting a 12-gauge shotgun into the New York Stock Exchange and the New York Times on the Stock Exchange page. And while you shoot it once and you've got bullets that are sort of scattered and none of the companies connect, but I guess you'd have to keep shooting and shooting and shooting until all that information overlaps, or it's sort of a large puzzle, sort of the pieces start to fit together. You're going to need... So you can have transient information from one organism to the next.
That's exactly right. They're all linked. That's exactly right. And one of the ways that you can make those linkages is the sampling over time. So there's a little bit of a sense of maybe.
Is it doable?
I mean, I would never say to completion, but we're going to learn an awful lot. And there's a lot of techniques that have been developed over the course of trying just to understand genomes, phylogeny.
So you are sequencing? Are you sequencing? So you isolate these large genetic elements of 100.
Yeah, well, you don't have to isolate large ones. There's many ways to skin a cat, right? You can do so. Craig Venter and his group and others are going out and doing kind of more standard shotgun sequencing. So small insert 3 kilobase size genome libraries. And one group in particular, Jill Banfield at UC Berkeley, working with very simple microbial mats, has been actually able to assemble several whole microbial genomes from a complex natural community, but moderate in complexity. Now, when you get out into the ocean, the diversity and complexity is so high that assembly is really not in the realm of possibility.
So what are the methodologies that are allowing you to sequence these genomes, and how far are you? Is it possible to sequence them all? I mean,
so we probably won't sequence entire microbial genomes as frequently, at least initially, in some of these more complex populations as we're used to in kind of laboratory strains. And there's a number of reasons. And it's not just due to the diversity of different microbial species that are within a community, but also within any different species group, there are many, many variants, many, many subtypes that live in the same community. And so you have many variations on a theme of any individual species that live in these communities. So typically what we're doing right now, and what others in the field have been doing, is really getting a genome sampling. And it's basically gene and genome sampling at a pretty high scale that's going on right now. Now, down the road, the methods will change, and we will probably be seeing lots more whole microbial genomes coming from these complex mixed populations. And probably that's going to happen with single-cell techniques. So it's looking like it may be more and more possible to sort individual cells by techniques like flow cytometry. And then using rolling circle amplification techniques that people are developing right now, it's looking like someday it may be possible to amplify and sequence whole genomes from individual cells.
Well, that's going to require a huge amount of server power to assemble
these. Well, this is the interesting thing. So if you take a look at the amount of data that's being generated now, the number of new types of genes that are simply coming from studies like Craig Venter's Sargasso Sea study, they'll soon exceed the number of gene types that are now recorded in GeneBank. It's a bit of the never-ending story, right? We're not limited anymore by the organisms that are in the lab or kind of narrowly focused on vertebrate species. People are sampling extant life in a genomic sense, and that gene database will rapidly overgrow any kind of biomedical databases and so on, probably pretty soon. Now, that's
exciting
issue
on two levels, I think, in terms of just looking at Venus in the waves or just seeing genes for the first time on organisms that are completely novel. It must be fantastic, but I guess Dr. Andy is also just looking, wow, his BioBricks program will get, you know, an enormous set of...
Talk about grist for the mill. And one of the things that I like to think about a lot is that, you know, typically if you think about Dr. Andy and his concept of BioBricks, which I think is really neat, you're typically working from local optima. You happen to have, say maybe it's this one green fluorescent protein that you got from an organism because you just happen to have it. But is that really the best one to use? And there's two approaches to that. You can try and engineer the gene that you already have, and so you start from one optima and try and work to another better local optima. But nature's been messing around with lots of these proteins for billions of years, and there are probably more global optima for many types of functions and processes that we simply haven't sampled.
If you want one that can tolerate heat or tolerate pH change So you could actually go to the metadata that you associate with the various genes and say, well, this organism was found in this extreme environment. There was no oxygen available. There was a very low pH, very acidic, and I guess the engineers will be ecstatic.
Yeah,
this.
This is an approach that's really been taken in some companies, which is to, if you want that enzyme that works well in detergent at high temperature and so on, you can actually find a habitat that mimics those conditions and use it. So in terms of green chemistry, in terms of tailoring enzymes for particular jobs under particular conditions, this sort of approach has real merit. And but you wonder also too what sorts of new functions or unrealized kind of optima are out there that we haven't even sampled yet, and it will be really interesting to see what we're missing. And this example that I told you about of rhodopsins is really interesting. In essence, we stumbled into a new kind of photosynthesis in the sea, if you will. And it turns out it's not rare at all. Initially, we thought, wow, we were really lucky to find this photoprotein. We weren't lucky. These things are so common, it's ridiculous. And we just hadn't had a way to sample them before. And then once you start looking, what you find is, wow. And so this is a major mode of metabolism that influences energy flux in the ocean that we simply couldn't see. And I guess that's one of the major points about some of these, the new microscope of genomics that we can use out in the environment lets us see a lot of things that were just hidden from our vision before.
And I think if you're selecting an environment that's what most people consider a complete desert, right, and you're seeing these very complex microbial communities, and on top of those microbial communities, of course, you've got the viruses that are, you know, living in conjunction with these communities. And you're finding fantastic new information. Imagine if you you move back towards or towards other environments, every environment on Earth. If you go north, south, east, west, you go to urban environments, you're going to find an enormous wealth of information. And
every place you look, I mean, you could imagine. I mean, I don't think anybody really even knows this yet, but
the bathroom wall,
close to the truth. Every different leaf on every different plant could have a whole different kind of microbial community with different metabolic properties, suites of genes, and so on. It is scary in the sense that the numbers that we're talking about and the levels of diversity and our ability to cope with them, I don't care how much storage space you have or bandwidth, we've got a lot to learn yet, and techniques are going to have to develop along with that too, or we're going to run out of storage space probably for all these genes that people are finding.
So a really weird segue here, but so you won an Apple Bioinformatics Award. This is kind of interesting, maybe also to the TWiD audience, that Apple is supporting this eco-genomics, or you might want to call it. Could you tell us a little bit about the Apple and Bioinformatics program?
Well, so that was interesting. I think it really was kind of a promotional on the part of Apple, and the reason is because they have an interest in scientific applications. You know, the Apple system runs on a Unix. They're now that they've switched over to Intel chips, they're really, you know, I don't want to do an ad for Apple, but their servers are pretty powerful, fairly competitive, and you can build large clusters. And one of the things that Apple does for someone like myself, so remember, I'm a microbiologist. I'm not a computer scientist.
Right.
But
right.
I'm managing a fairly large computational cluster. Now, how can I do that? The reason, actually, that I can do that is because some of the software that Apple has implemented for systems administration and so on, someone like myself who's not, you know, as computer savvy can handle.
Yeah, I guess it's not about the mug. It's about the coffee, right? And if you're struggling to deal with a network issue or whatnot using, say, perhaps a Linux or an XP, I mean, Apple does make it really slick. So what kind of servers are you using, and what kind of support is Apple giving?
They have made it pretty easy to build a cluster. I mean, the hardware is superb. The software is pretty good for things like building a RAID and monitoring RAID, so storage issues, as well as coupling to a computer cluster. There's third-party solutions for helping to build that cluster. And kind of the management software, so you can manage parallel computing using things like the SunGrid engine. So the SunGrid engine works really well as a management system on an Apple cluster, for instance. So there are kind of out-of-the-box solutions that aren't too hard to implement. so that, you know, someone like myself who is a biologist and I'm interested in focusing on the biological questions and kind of the analytical techniques, the informatics that we need to do this kind of comparative genomics. What I'm really not interested in is the details of managing the cluster and so
or futzing. Apple, you don't want to futz, right?
So you can do it. Basically, we're managing now. Once it gets set up, and typically I'll work with some experts for a day or two to set things up in kind of consult mode, outsource it. But once we're set up, the management's not too hard, and so you know, I've been managing for a while an 80 CPU cluster, and we just doubled it, and it's not not a large issue. So I think one thing
is it enough?
Well,
do you want more?
I think that it's let's back up a second. I was really lucky to win this award, and I think that we're trying to break some new ground. But the reality is, it's going to take a lot of people working together. Databases need to be centralized. Computational facilities need to be centralized. People need to work together on this. And so there's kind of an evolution that's starting to happen, and it needs to happen, where this field itself of, if you will, environmental genomics or metagenomics, it's starting to be recognized that, A, there's some utility to it, and there's utility in the biomedical arena, there's utility in the biotechnology and industrial arena, and there's utility in environmental science and ecology for sure. So it's pretty big. Not only that, this field is going to generate bigger data sets than we've ever seen before.
Right.
And so now let's think about something like GenBank. Is GenBank ready for this? Well, they know it's coming, and they're starting to get ready. But it requires a little bit of a different mode because it's not one gene, one organism anymore. It really torques some of our ideas about taxonomy. Now it's many genes from a particular environment at a particular point in space and time, and people are starting to go out, and there will be many points in space and time being sampled with megabase to gigabase sized data sets.
Right. Well, as I was saying, you're going from a desert to a very rich environment.
Yeah. So these are really interesting areas, and it's what people are thinking and talking about right now. How are we going to do this in a way that we capture as much of the information, not just the nucleotide sequences, but all the other information that's going to allow us to interpret that data as soon as we can? Because it's a lost opportunity if we don't do that now. So I think it's really cool because people are talking about this now. It's really parallel a lot of the problems or challenges that were seen in the beginnings of genomics, in the beginnings of microarray experiments, and so on. And there's a lot of good people involved. I'm really kind of impressed at how it's taking off, where some of the leaders in the area of genomics, you know, folks like Mike Ashburner and Craig Venter and Claire Frazier, a number of real leaders are thinking hard about the questions and problems that are involved in this kind of newly emerging field, many of which are parallel to that of genomics and some of which are different, and thinking about how we're going to respond as a community to capture as much of this data as possible and put ourselves in a position to be able to analyze it in meaningful ways. So I'm tremendously excited about what's going on right now, obviously.
No, yeah, definitely. No, I agree. I think this is one of the great things about doing a biotech podcast. While it covers, you know, somewhat of a wide range of issues from evolution to environmental ecology or environmental genomics. How would you coin the term? The term that sort of
So the term that's caught on for this field is metagenomics.
Metagenomics.
Wow. Yeah, so that's what people are referring to it as, and that's really
the Earth's
the application of genomic techniques to natural microbial communities. And there's many elements of that. You can use it to learn about the natural history of microbes in these communities and their ecology. You can use it for bioprospecting. I mean, think about it. If we limited ourselves to the antibiotics, only those antibiotics that organisms that we can culture produce, we're really limiting our possibilities. But now we can start to think about opening up to the world of microbes in the wild, and certainly there's lots more.
I guess you don't have to look into space to find incredible organisms. There's quite a few here that we just haven't seen yet, so it's got to be very exciting.
It's absolutely true. We know a little bit less about life on Earth than some would have us believe.
One question I had was, in the northeastern part of the United States, I guess you tend to probably go out to the regions of near Hawaii in the winter.
That's a good question. Let me tell you about that. This is a bit historical because I'm actually from the West Coast originally, but there's a reason. So we just had funded by the National Science Foundation a new NSF Science and Technology Center, and it's called CMOR, and that's an acronym for the Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education. And this will be a 10-year running program that builds on a 20-year time series. So out at the Hawaii Ocean Time Series Station, a fellow named Dave Carl, who's a director of this NSF Science and Technology Center, has for the past 20 years been running a time series, going out to the site every 3 weeks and doing profiles, taking measurements of all the oceanographic parameters. There's instruments that are strung out there taking continuous measurements. The satellites are looking down on the site. So you have this rich historical context of what is making that environment tick. And the thing that's missing, really, is the fine-scale biology. You know, how are the microbes form the vast majority of the biomass out in these particular environments? How does that work? Because it's coupled. It's a biological, physical, chemical kind of coupled environment. So
he uses satellite information?
How's that?
You're saying he uses satellite data?
So we do use satellite data, not in the way you might think, though. So it turns out there's really complex things happening hydrologically, oceanographically.
Okay.
So large eddies spin through the ocean around the southern side of the Hawaiian Islands that are, 50 kilometers across. And these things are moving parcels of water around that have different properties than the water.
Oh, so you'd absolutely have to track that.
And you can see those from space. Yeah. So you can actually, in real time, drive a ship to a feature that you're looking at with satellites and then measure the physics and chemistry and biology, relative to surrounding water. So in a very real sense, yeah, you can use satellites to do oceanography in real time.
Well, not just oceanography, but microbial ecology.
So this is the thing. No, we're not looking at microbes from space, but we can look at their effects. So you can see color from space. People measure chlorophyll.
Right, exactly. So you can look at subcellular compartments from space by looking at the green, right?
In some sense. Now the reality is, of course, it's a very crude cut. You can, for instance, for anything that you're measuring with light, like chlorophyll, you can only see about one optical depth down. You're using a lot of different proxies and kind of fudge factors to pull these out. So you really have to be there.
No,
and
definitely.
And so now I'm trying to answer your question. Why go to Hawaii? The bottom line is because there's a really rich historical series of measurements. There's a bunch of really good people, both oceanographers and microbiologists, that are keen to study the site, and they're doing that right now. And we really can start to resolve the microbial populations in the context of this particular environment. And yeah, in the Northeast, in the winter, it's a good idea to head out there and study some.
My thought, but sure, it's still a lot of work. I mean, field work can be extremely rough, and the weather's not always permitting. And if you need that data set, you need that time point, and the system's not reacting the way.
Yeah, you can't. Mother Nature calls the shots, basically.
Right.
So
and,
it isn't always a cakewalk.
And it's tough on the family too. It's definitely tough on the family
too. Yeah, it is.
Too.
Lots of traveling and that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, a lot of air miles. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. This is
that's okay.
A great
opportunity. It's really fun talking to you, and I can't wait to Actually, I can't wait to hear Drew's podcast. That's tomorrow, right?
I think so. I think we're going to put it up.
So that was our conversation with Dr. Ed DeLong from MIT. I'd really like to thank him for his time today. I'd also like to thank Drs. Harry Gill and Mark Parker for assisting with the show notes, and Philip Pelsey for providing much of the equipment used to record this netcast. Thanks to the band Gunther for their theme. Their music is available at cyclonerecords.ca. And for comments and suggestions, please visit our site at www.twit.tv/fib or leave a message using Skype. Our Skype handle is Futures in Biotech. For the disclaimer, the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.